and welcome. Today is Friday, April 12th, 2019, and it is 10:34 a.m. This is panel number 4201, and the disruptive tech keynote address, The Internet and Humanity. I'm Allison Kuhl. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology here at CU Boulder, where I teach and do research on science, technology, and society. It's my honor and pleasure today to be able to introduce our keynote speaker, Barrett Anderson. Barrett is the co-founder, CEO, and editor-in-chief of Scout.ai, a media company that brings together journalism, analysis, and science fiction to offer an innovative perspective on the future of technology. She is an internationally acclaimed writer and speaker. Barrett's work with Scout draws on the powerful insight that writing science fiction and designing technology are both deeply human ways of envisioning possible futures. Just as an author summons forth a world or a universe in a story, a future utopia or dystopia, as a scene for exploring moral and social questions about how we live, how we might live, and how we should live, so too do developers, engineers, and technologists use circuits and solder, code and algorithms as imaginative devices and world-making tools. In writing, in art, and in design and engineering, reality is what is at stake. Barrett Anderson, in creating this novel amalgamation of sci-fi and reporting, shows us how technological questions are always also social concerns. The shiny surfaces of our phones and our laptops belie the complexity of the cultural, economic, and ethical connections that sustain the systems and infrastructure of our digital society. In other words, technology is where we should be looking if we want to understand ourselves and our society. Good journalism peels away the superficial appearance of things to show us something deeper and truer, what is really happening. And science fiction writers, working with the same raw materials of fact and narrative, make reality feel real. When I was preparing for today, I immediately thought of the science fiction author Ursula K. Le Guin, who's well known for her richly imagined novels. She's also the daughter of two anthropologists, Theodora and Alfred Kroeber. And for many anthropologists, including me, we recognize something of our own aspirations to understand the human side of technology in her work. In the introduction to one of her novels, The Left Hand of Darkness, Le Guin challenges the idea of science fiction as a form of prediction. She wrote, quote, "This book is not about the future. Yes, it begins by announcing that it is set in the ecumenical year 1490 through 97, but surely you don't really believe that. Yes, indeed, the people in it are androgynous, but that doesn't mean I'm predicting that in a millennium or so we'll all be androgynous, or announcing that I think we damned well ought to be androgynous. I'm merely observing in the peculiar, devious, and thought experimental manner proper to science fiction that if you look at us at certain odd times of day, in certain weathers, we already are. I'm not predicting or prescribing. I'm describing," end quote. So in this current moment of misinformation, automation, and redirection, these kinds of descriptions of who we are and what we have the capacity to become are more important than ever. We are very fortunate to have Barrett Anderson, who is doing just this kind of descriptive work, with us here today to talk about the Internet and humanity. Please join me in welcoming Barrett Anderson. Thank you, Allison. That was, I think, probably the best introduction I've ever had. Very, very poetic. So it's an honor to be here today. And I'm going to talk to you today about all the things that are wrong with the internet and how the internet broke society. But I want to start off by answering your first question from Q&A, which I know is going to come up. It always does. It's always the first question. And the answer is yes. I have a lot of hope. And there are a lot of things that we can do about these things. So I've been involved with the internet for a long time. I'm the one up here without the beard. And the internet actually allowed me to start my company. I would never have been able to do that without the internet. The internet does a lot of incredible things. You know, it provides education for millions of people around the world. I would never have gotten to meet these awesome science fiction authors, Cory Doctorow and Ram Esnam, if it weren't for the power of the internet. I would never have gotten the founder of eBay to tweet out my article if it weren't for the power of the internet. And I would never have found out that Rebecca Mercer had stolen the rules to a scenario planning game I created if it weren't for Jane Meyer and The New Yorker and the power of the internet. And last but not least, these two guys, two of my personal heroes, Peter Sagal and Max Temkin, who created Cards Against Humanity, I would never have been invited by them to travel to Chicago to play that scenario planning game for a bunch of their top political friends and allies if it weren't for the power of the internet. So I love the internet. It's a great thing. But I have a few qualms. I have a few things I think we should work on, you know, as a team. I'm going to take this off. So the internet has not been great for our personal privacy. And that's mostly because, you know, when the internet was designed, it was actually designed to connect just three research institutions, right? And the idea was it would scale to a couple of other research institutions, but it was not designed for what has happened today, which is we now have 3.2 billion users on the internet. And that was unexpected. So the other thing about the internet is that even today with our modern, like our most modern kind of encryption that you're seeing, this is the encryption that is used, HTTPS, which you'll see is used to send your bank information back and forth, your passwords, your usernames, your emails. It's pretty standard across websites today. It's very standard across websites today. But even that isn't really that secure, right? So back in 2012, we learned that the NSA could already basically decrypt most and on demand quite a few SSL connections, as well as getting into what are called VPNs, virtual private networks, so they could access VPNs. That was through the work of Edward Snowden. And the other thing is that there aren't a lot of internet companies that really care that much about our privacy either. So most of the apps that you have on your phone are asking you constantly to give them access to things like your email, right? So Google reads your emails frequently. And they also grant that access to other apps that would like to also read your email, you know? So I'm not a huge fan of that part either. The other thing, Alexa, right? So how many of you guys have an Alexa at home? Right, quite a lot. I have an Alexa at home. Not a smart thing, but I do. It was a gift from my dad, that guy who taught me how to use the internet. So the thing about Alexa, it was recently reported that not only is it really easy to break into if you really wanted to, like if you're a good hacker, I'm pretty sure you could get in there, but Amazon has also hired thousands of employees around the world whose job it is to listen to what you say to Alexa and help her figure out how to get better at responding, right? So that's okay maybe if it's an anonymized voice saying, hey Alexa, would you play Bob Dylan? But they've also overheard some pretty alarming things, like they've overheard some examples of domestic abuse. They've overheard conversations that were accidentally recorded by Alexa, because the thing about Alexa is that she records anything that you say when you say anything near what she thinks her name sounds like, right? So that's not great for privacy. And then the other thing about the internet is that because we are now moving to a time when we're saying and doing and buying everything online, that's a lot of data about you that's suddenly out there in the world, right? So data brokers are companies online that have access to pretty much all of your purchase history. They may have access to your genetic history if you have publicly allowed 23andMe to use your DNA or any of those other assorted genetic databases. They know what you're looking at, what you're reading. They know what political groups you're affiliated with. They know where you work. They know what your zip code is. They know what your income level is. And so all of that data is aggregated by these companies and sold to advertisers. So that's not great for privacy either. Now, in the U.S., we're still in like a pretty good zone, but facial recognition is becoming very, very prevalent, right? If you've ever used Clear, for example, right, saves you a lot of time at the airport. You can sign up, you just breeze right through the security lines. But what you're giving up in that case is your iris, your retina scan, your facial recognition, your fingerprints. And in China, they're using facial recognition like that all across the country to help inform their social credit scores. So they have a system that allows them to track what you're saying online in your private messages, who you're friends with, what you're buying, what you're doing, and they're using facial recognition and surveillance throughout the country to track you and figure out where you are at any given point. They have a facial recognition system to track jaywalkers. So if you've jaywalked a certain number of times, they know you've jaywalked a certain number of times. And unfortunately, that means if you have a bad social credit rating score because you hang out with people who are critical of the government, or you know, you said something kind of slightly critical of the government yourself, maybe once privately, thinking that no one was reading it, you're not able to actually buy flights internationally or travel domestically either, frequently. In addition to it actually affecting your credit score, right? So your ability to buy a home or take out a loan or any of these things. So that bothers me. I'm not a huge fan of that. So the next thing is the internet broke free will. And you might say, you know, well, yeah, right. And sure, each of us have the power to overcome this, but on aggregate, people are spending about 2.5 hours a day on social networks. So that's a lot of time to be looking at Facebook and Instagram in your day. Just think about all the things you could do in that time if you took it. And this is not an accident. All of these social networks were designed to be as addictive as possible. This was actually originally came from a Stanford course that was put on by this guy, B.J. Fogg, who runs the Persuasive Technology Lab at Stanford. And this model that's laid out here is the model that kind of underlies all of these social networks, right? So they're looking at B equals MAP, right? So B is behavior, M is motivation, ability, and a prompt, right? So the idea is that your behavior, human behavior, can be easily tricked by combining the right motivation with the ease of doing something and a reminder to do it at that certain time. So if you think about the times that you've used Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, all of those companies are using that principle to get you to come back as frequently as possible, to spend as much time as possible on the app. That's why they invented what's called the infinite scroll, which the founder regretted, or the creator regretted later, because he didn't realize how much it would contribute to social network addiction. And this class was taken by both the founders of Instagram and the guy who had gone to become the head of growth at both Facebook and Uber. So it's a pretty well-known model. So this is the abstract from a study by a guy named Michal Kaczynski. And Michal Kaczynski is most famous because he created the original research that correlated Facebook likes with personality traits. So his research was actually stolen from him by Cambridge Analytica and used to, they replicated what he had done and used that to create their personality profiles, which were, that were used in the election to target people with specific messages or specific ideas that they knew would appeal to your personality. And so Michal, after this all happened, did this additional study, and he, in which he proved that there is a significant correlation between the ability to do that kind of work, that kind of message testing based on your personality, and the efficacy of that. So he found that it is actually very effective and can be used very negatively. So the third thing is that the internet broke our minds. So a lot of people say, well, you know, the internet's just a tool. It can be used for good or bad. And that's, you know, I can see where they're coming from, but you're wrong. So the way that our brains work is through something called neuroplasticity. And what that means is that your brain, even as an adult, can change. Because anytime you do something, the neurotransmitters firing between the neurons in your brain are reinforcing a pathway for that behavior. And the more times in a row that you do that behavior, the deeper those pathways become, which means that it's harder and harder to shift those habits. That's how we form good habits. It's also how we form bad habits. And it's why it matters that these social networks have been designed to be so addictive. So what does that mean for our actual brains? So there was a study that came out a few years ago by a woman. Sorry, I've got a little tech glitch, so my notes are on a separate device. But UCLA developmental psychologist Patricia Greenfield, and she did a study of, she did a review of a bunch of different studies to try and figure out how is the internet actually affecting our brains. And so she found that we've become really good at a couple of things, right? So we're really good at the widespread and sophisticated development of visual spatial skills, video games, right? We're good at creating videos. And because of the same factor, neuroplasticity, we're also really good at skimming and scanning and multitasking. By the way, because this is a talk about the internet, I've used GIFs as much as possible. So we'll keep them coming. But the problem is that it's also affected our brain in some negative ways. So there's a very high correlation between increased suicide risk, depression, and actual suicide among teens. That's been correlated directly with increased internet use. In addition to that, there, you know, teens are having a harder and harder time connecting with each other, a fact which is evidenced by the fact that teens are having 10% less sex today than they were 10 years ago. So the other thing is that, unfortunately, the internet has been bad for some kind of critical functions in the human brain, right? One of which is imagination. We've gotten worse at being imaginative. And we've also gotten worse at things like mindful knowledge acquisition, inductive analysis, critical thinking, and reflection. So that's not a great outcome. Melinda will tell you, because we're entering a time now, and we're living in a world where we really, really need critical thinking skills, right? We're facing all of these big, hairy challenges, and they've never been as complex and as multifaceted as they are today, but at the same time, our brains are getting dumber at solving those problems. So let's look at a couple of those. So one, automation and artificial intelligence will result in somewhere between 600 million and a billion jobs being lost worldwide by 2030.
And this shows you kind of like a breakdown of what that job loss will kind of look like. But if you think about, you know, what are the jobs that are easily automated? So truck drivers, for example, is the number one full-time adult occupation in 29 U.S. states. Those jobs are all going away. Think about your Uber drivers. Those jobs are all going away. A lot of the service industry jobs that have been holding up a portion of the population that has not been benefiting from increasing inequality. And as you can see, that inequality is only getting worse. So this is a result of a couple of things. One, we've gotten worse at recognizing monopolies. So we have a lot of companies right now that are operating as effectively as monopolies, Amazon, Google, Facebook, but they're data monopolies. And our ability to regulate those companies is not set up to recognize the internet, right? So that's something we need to change and we need to work on. Oceans are getting much hotter, right? That's not great, especially not for the fish and the plankton that live in the oceans. To say nothing of ocean acidification, which is supposed to, you know, I've heard it is a big worry for oceanographers right now about whether or not it will kill plankton, so in the next 5 to 10 years, which, by the way, creates one in five breaths that we take. So that's not great either. And temperatures are rising quite a bit. This is a global map of total change in temperature rise since 1970, but as you can see, pretty much worldwide, except for a few places, we've gotten up to anywhere between 1 to 3 degrees Celsius. And then information warfare. So this is a map of what the internet looked like before the last election. So you can see all of these sites in the middle. This is basically what it looks like to game search engine optimization. So if you're trying to game Google, this is what you do. All the sites in the middle are traditional news sites. And those sites have a lot of inbound links, right? There are a lot of people linking to them because they're sharing their articles, they're visiting Google, they're visiting YouTube, they're going to Amazon, they're going to Fox News. But all of these sites out around the edges are actually sites that are all linking to each other. So they're faking to the internet that they are doing the exact same things as the sites in the middle. And what that means is that when that happens during the last election cycle, what we saw was those sites, anytime, you know, these were all far-right sites, mostly, I don't think they were all far-right sites, but anytime bad news came out about Trump, they would then put out bad news about Hillary and really propel bad news to the top of search engine results. So that if someone was trying to figure out what was going on in the election, those results would be artificially placed high up in the search results. The other thing is the internet has become the new battlefield for political power. I talked about this on one of our panels yesterday or the day before. But there's an arms race going on between China and the United States, but also between Russia, right? Using the internet as a new means of warfare. So we're no longer relying on expensive means of warfare, like bombs and other, like sending troops to places, having new bases as much. China and Russia are really focused on different types of warfare, cyber warfare and economic warfare. So I'm going to show you a little bit more of what that looks like in practice. So one of the things about the internet, the HTTPS protocol that I talked about earlier, is that it can be broken. The only reason it works right now is because our computers right now aren't very good at processing large strings of prime numbers. That's how you break HTTPS encryption. And so as a result, China and the U.S. are currently in an arms race to create the first quantum computer. Because whoever creates the first quantum computer can effectively break all website encryption. And if you were the one to do that first, you probably wouldn't be shouting from the rooftops about the fact that you'd done it, because you wouldn't want anyone to know that you were reading all of the emails and all the transactions that were going back and forth across the web. But you can see China has actually far surpassed us in the amount that they're investing in that pursuit. So last year, Atlanta was attacked by a massive cyber attack. It took down most of their critical infrastructure, including their municipal computer systems, their records keeping, and it lasted for several days. They tried to ransom, get them to pay a large amount in Bitcoin to get their systems back online, but they just found that there were a couple of Iranian hackers behind that. And then this is economic warfare. So Huawei is a 5G provider, right? They're trying to become the 5G provider throughout Europe. But the problem is that Huawei is effectively owned by the Chinese government, by the Chinese Communist Party, which means that any kind of internet infrastructure that's built out in their name has some kind of backdoor built into it that will allow them to kind of figure out what your, you know, track your messages, track your communications, your mobile communications. And so there's a big fight going on right now throughout Europe about whether or not to allow Huawei to come in and put 5G in, and that's why. The U.S. has been very anti-Huawei, not anti-5G. So this is we have a lot of things to deal with, right? These are a lot of big problems, and they can feel really, really daunting and very scary. They can feel really make you feel quite helpless. But you really don't need to feel that helpless, because there are a bunch of things that you can do right now start changing the game. So, the first step, before we do anything else, we want to reclaim our critical thinking skills. So please, if you're interested in this, take out your phone and take a picture of this right now. That is an acceptable use of your mobile device. So I still have my Facebook app, but I've deleted my Instagram app. I turn my phone to grayscale as much as possible. And this is something that one of my friends taught me, who used to work in advertising. If you have an iPhone, you can open your iPhone up right now, and you can go into your settings. And underneath the privacy section of your settings, there's a section called advertising. Now this is, they hide it really well, because they don't really want you to figure this out, because they make a bunch of money from collecting all of your data, your browsing data from your phone. But within that, there's a place that says, once you go into that section, you can turn off your advertising tracking within your phone. And then really importantly, you should reset your advertising ID, which that's what they use to track you and keep tell that you're still the same person using the same, with the same interests and data associated with you to track you and advertise to you across devices.
Settings,
privacy, advertising. If you have a different kind of phone, I'm sorry, but I don't know what to do. But I'm sure you could Google it. Reset your advertising ID. And turn off ad tracking. All right, so that's kind of basic. The other thing that you can do is you can opt out of a lot of these data broker sites. It is a pain in the butt, but you can do it. So you can actually take your information off of all of these sites. Not all of them, but I think most of them. There's a really, really great article about this that walks you through. These are all of the top sites, data broker sites. These are the ones that are high priority for you to take your stuff out of them. Here's how you do it. And it will tell you, you can do this one online, you can do this one, you have to write it. Some of them you have to write a letter or send in your driver's license number, so that's a little bit more complicated, but it's worth doing. I will tweet that out after the talk so you guys can see it. The second thing you can do is send your kids outside. In fact, you could send yourself outside too. There was a very interesting study conducted that found that, in spite of all of those negative effects of internet use that we talked about before, there was a study conducted in 2014 that found that after just 5 days at an outdoor retreat without phones, kids had a much a huge increase in their ability to empathize with other people. And they also, you know, they were more likely to feel sympathetic towards each other when they fell down. They were doing things like orienteering and outdoor, other kind of like brain athletic activity combinations, archery. So there, it's not an unsolvable problem. The third thing that we can do, this is less on the internet side of things, but Costa Rica, you know, we get told a lot. It has to deal with one of our problems. So we get told a lot as Americans that there's nothing we can do about climate change. It's an intractable problem. And there's not enough political will to do anything about it. And as someone who believes in science, I would like to call bullshit on that. So check this out. This is Costa Rica. Pretty nice, right? Very beautiful. They have a lot of natural beauty there. How many of you have been there? How many of you would be willing to live in a country with the same level of goods and services as Costa Rica? Most, okay, about half of those. So Costa Rica has done something really incredible, which is for the last 6 months, they have been using only renewable energy, entirely, their entire country. And they've done it by changing all of their buses to electric buses. They've invested very heavily in renewables. They have created a tax break. So anyone who buys an electric vehicle under $30,000 doesn't have to pay taxes on that vehicle, which means that not only is it incentivizing people to buy electric vehicles, it's incentivizing car companies to make cheap electric vehicles so that people can buy the electric vehicles. They're also about to get, in 2019, they're scheduled to get their first carbon neutral airline. So a lot of, you know, I talk to a lot of kind of climate speakers, actually, who go around the world and fly around the world, and that's like the biggest guilt thing that they have. And we always think, oh, there's nothing I can do about airlines, right? But if there's nothing you could, even if we don't have the technology yet to create an airline that is not, that doesn't rely on fuel, our traditional fuel, we absolutely do have the technology to do the things that would put that carbon back into the atmosphere, right? So they have a very intense program for replanting and reforestation, and the airline has committed to replanting a tree for every single person who buys a ticket on that flight. And they've also done a lot to protect marine environments, right? So the ocean provides so. I don't think we think about this very much, especially maybe not in Colorado, because you guys don't see the ocean very much. I'm from Seattle, so I see it a lot and I think about it a lot. But the ocean provides so much of the green CO2 that we need to breathe, right? And it's really, really suffering. So Costa Rica has made it a big priority to protect the oceans and to create, whatever they're called. Ocean protection zones around the country. So the fourth thing that we can do is a creative commons system for personal data. So this is not that hard to do, right? Like, the biggest problem that we're having right now is that we have no control over who owns our data, and we have no ability to regulate or to say ourselves who gets to use our data and for what, right? Which means that someone could come along and say an insurance agency, and say, hey, I want to buy, you know, Barrett's genetic data, which I haven't put online, but if I had, they could. And then I also want to know her income levels and her purchasing habits, and, like, has she been purchasing any alcohol lately or cigarettes? Because if that happens and then I can look at her genetic data, then I can see that I'm definitely not going to give her insurance. So this is really important. There are people that are working on this already, which is great. And the technological architecture exists to do this. So this is Tim Berners-Lee. He was the original creator of the World Wide Web. And he's working on a platform called Solid. He has built a platform called Solid that allows you to have, on the existing internet, the ownership of your data and to license your data to specific apps. He just started this, so he's building out the kind of first iteration of it now, but he's working on it. And I think, in a way even more interesting to me, there's another system in Estonia, which is blockchain-based identity. So Estonia has this really cool thing because they got attacked really early on by Russia. So they were under constant cyber attack, right? Their electrical grid was taken down multiple times. They were under, you know, they were constantly barraged by information warfare. And so what they did to try and protect themselves against this was they created a blockchain-based citizenship, which is really cool, right? That means that, so the way the blockchain works is that each node on the network, each person, basically, is a node. And I'm a node, and you're a node, and you're a node. But any time I make a transaction on that architecture, there's a record of that transaction on your node, and on my node. And I can't necessarily see, you can't necessarily see what my transactions are, but they're there, right? Which means that it's almost impossible to hack. So you would have to have 51% of the nodes on that network in order to hack that system and break into that data. But the cool thing is that it also allows them to do things like vote completely digitally, right? And in a pretty secure way. And they can also create companies using their e-identity, as they call it. And if you are not from Estonia, you can actually still create companies. You can create your own e-identity and create a company using that. And that keeps an ongoing record. You know, you don't have to keep your paper copies or try and remember what your, you know, business identification number is, or your tax identification number. So it just makes things easier, as well as being more secure. That could easily be used, this architecture, or something like this, could easily be used to create a similar thing that protects your data and allows you to grant access to specific parties that have your data, or revoke access to parties that don't have your data, that you don't want to have your data. So the other thing is that as we go through this process, it's going to take a while to set up the system, but there are a lot of groups out there that are doing really important work. So this is an agreement from the Future of Privacy Forum, which has facilitated an agreement between all of these genetic services that they will not actually give your genetic data out unless they have your permission, right? Or there's a search warrant. And this was prompted by actually the finding of the a revisited murder case in California, I think, where they actually got the genetic data from this database without consent or a search warrant, right? So luckily, they found the guy who did it. Unluckily, or maybe luckily for us, it highlighted this really important thing where they could suddenly get genetic data without any kind of warrant. So anyways, these guys have done a really good job. They've looped in 23andMe, Ancestry, Helix, MyHeritage, and Habit. And they've also done a really good job of calling out family tree DNA, which you'll notice is crossed out on this slide, because they actually broke the promise right after they made it. So it's a good way to track kind of who you can trust and who you can't, to some degree. And the fifth thing you can do is you can support tech workers organizing for change. So one of the ways, I travel a lot internationally and I speak about, you know, people always ask me, how can you actually change these tech companies that are doing these things? They're never going to change. How do you even begin to think about having an impact? So, I mean, deleting, if everyone walked out of here today and deleted Facebook on their phone, they might notice that. But they are losing users really quickly. And so overall, we are making a difference, because a lot of people don't want to use Facebook anymore in particular. But so the other thing you can do is to support tech workers organizing for change. This has been actually really effective. So after the election, Facebook denied that they had played any role whatsoever in the outcome of the election. They denied. Mark Zuckerberg was like, no, it's ridiculous that we would have played a part in this. Obama pulled him aside and was like, hey, this is a big deal. We need you to do something about this. And he's like, no, it's fine. It's cool. We're good. And it wasn't until they had a kind of basically like a little mini internal coup, right? They had an employee coup that they actually changed their behavior and they started to do things to protect their users from information warfare. And that's because the most One of the most important assets in Silicon Valley is talent, right? There is an extreme shortage of development talent and artificial intelligence talent, and what that means is that if your employees are unhappy and they're talking to the media, that looks really bad for Facebook, right? Like, they're going to have a really hard time, and they are having a really hard time right now recruiting new talent, right? So that actually affects their bottom line pretty significantly, and they listen to that. And you'll see that this has happened not just at Facebook, but this is in Seattle. We have this company you might have heard of. A group of about 20 employees, not very many, got together and signed a shareholder resolution because they were so frustrated with how little Amazon thought about its environmental impact. And so just in the last couple of months, the fact that they've signed that shareholder resolution, they refused to kind of negotiate with, you know, they refuse. Sometimes they try and get them to get rid of the resolution. They weren't going to do that. They're like, we're going to bring the resolution to the shareholder meeting, which means that all of the shareholders now have to vote on it. Amazon doesn't like that because it makes them look bad, and it gets in the way of the business that they want to do and the message that they want to send about their shareholder meeting. So they've already hurried up the release of a plan that they were working on, and now they've put together this signature letter that has gotten signatures from, I think, about 5,000 employees at Amazon, which is a pretty big number for that company. So they're applying more pressure, and it's already having an impact. This is another example. So Google was providing censored search results in China. And Google employees were not happy about this. They found out about it, and they got upset because they didn't feel that they should be involved in censorship. And they protested. And as a result, Google decided to pull their Chinese censored search engine. It now redirects to their normal search engine, basically. And then here's another thing. So they've had a big problem with diversity. And they had a user or an employee walkout recently after they announced this AI ethics board that wasn't actually making any changes to the internal parts of the company that were building the artificial intelligence. It was a completely external board, and it had some kind of controversial people on it. The employees got upset. Now they have a new diversity chief. So the sixth thing that you can do is you can create policy that operates according to the law of quarterly self-interest. So there's a very simple equation to figure out how to create policy that actually works when you're thinking about these kinds of companies and putting consumer protections in place. And the rule is that it has to hurt them a little bit, at least, in order for them to care about the policy. And there have to be teeth to enforce that policy in order for them to care about the policy. So if Congress came out right now with a law that said, we're going to charge you $1 million anytime, you know, if we find that you have, violated user rights or spread fake news, that probably wouldn't necessarily be that much of an incentive, because Facebook doesn't care about $1 million. They have $1 million, you know, for breakfast. So they just with their coffee, they have $1 million. But Germany actually put together a policy ahead of their election because they saw what had happened in the United States. They saw what had happened in Brexit. They saw information warfare taking place across all of these other elections in Europe. And they said, we don't want that to happen to us. What can we do? What kind of policies can we put in place that will keep that from happening? And they put in place a policy that fined Facebook or any other social platform 50 million euros if they didn't remove any piece of fake content within 24 hours. So that's a pretty stringent policy, right? And Facebook sat up and took notice. They still screwed up a little bit. I think they're actually trying to prosecute them for at least one fine. But it definitely made them pay attention, and they put a lot of effort and energy into the German election and into monitoring the German election and trying to make sure that it wasn't attacked in the same way that the U.S. election was. So the last thing that you can do is be nice to each other. So all of this information warfare stuff, all of the political polarity that you are experiencing online, that is all by design. And it turns out that what these companies... what these companies are designed to do is to create animosity between people. And what these countries, like Russia, are trying to do is to create political polarity. And so the best weapon that you actually have against information warfare is just to be kind to other people. Just like these cute animals. That's all I got.
I have some questions I can ask you.
So Allison's going to ask me some questions. That's not turned on. Do you want to do this one?
So we have some questions from the audience that people have submitted both using the note card system and through the app. To ask a question in the app, you just simply select this session in the schedule, tap Q&A, and then insert and send your question. You can also raise your hand to request a note card and pencil from one of our producers. Please write legibly, and if you are a student, note this in your question. So we've already had some questions come in via note cards and through the app. And our first question from a student is really about this question of policy. And the student wants to know what you think about the European model for data protection law, and if you think that the new European privacy law, the GDPR, has benefits that we can learn from here in the U.S.
So we've actually benefited a lot already in the United States from GDPR. GDPR was a law put into place in Europe that protected, that mandated certain standards for privacy and data privacy. And what happened is that because Europe was such a large market, none of the companies that were putting those standards in place actually wanted to create two different sets. They're not, none of them are going to create two different versions of their product because that's a huge pain in the ass, right? So we actually are already benefiting in the United States from those standards. That's true, I think, of and will be continue to be true for a lot of those kinds of standards that are put in place, right? So when we think about what do we have to do or what do we have to accomplish to change these things, there are many ways of thinking about this, right? You can think about it as, well, okay, Congress is so far behind and they'll never change anything. And, you know, in things are changing in Congress. I feel like people are getting a little more tech savvy. They're kind of catching up. So that's not entirely true. But we also are benefiting a lot from the European legislators who are much more privacy forward than we are in the United States. So that's been a boon for privacy here.
And we have a few different questions about the practical advice that you're giving about deleting Facebook. So one audience member wants to know, when we delete our Facebook accounts, what happens to our data? And another audience member asked, are there any search engines, like alternatives to Google, that you would recommend in addition to any other apps or add-ons that you think would be really effective for people to protect their privacy online?
So part of the reason I recommend specifically, you know, some of us have the benefit of being able to delete Facebook, some of us do not, right? But part of the reason that I specifically recommended deleting the apps does not actually delete your Facebook account, but Facebook and Instagram do monitor. Now, they'll tell you that they don't do this publicly, and Mark Zuckerberg has testified publicly that he doesn't do this. But based on observations of myself and many, many, many other people, many of whom you can find online, they actually use your microphone when you're not using the app to listen to your conversations and then target ads to you. So that is a big part of the reason why I recommend deleting the apps. And some of us have to use it for work, so it's not really an option. But if you can delete the app from your phone, then you won't, you know, have that same kind of thing. If you want to delete all of your data, you have to specifically go in and request it through Facebook. I can't remember exactly how you do it, but if you Google it, you can find it. If you want to use a different search engine, DuckDuckGo is actually quite good. There are a bunch of other search engines that are really committed to not gathering personal data. So I mean, there are a lot of resources out there. There are a bunch of other companies that are popping up to try to solve some of these problems, which is part of why I'm so optimistic. We have the ability to do this now. It's just more about public education and will. And for those companies that are trying to compete with Facebook, there's this thing called network effects, right? So it's really hard for us to leave Facebook because all of our friends and family are already there. Right? And it's very hard to overcome that. That's part of why it's so hard for any of these companies to compete with social networks, specifically. So the more of you that start using DuckDuckGo or start using alternative apps like that, the little quicker and quicker we start to shift those network effects.
So this question is about the issue of critical thinking that you raised. So here in Boulder, we're very committed to education. We're here at CU Boulder. We have some great public schools here, great public library. And so the question is really, is there a way that we can use education as a tool to help students and young people regain those critical thinking skills that are being lost?
Yeah. So a couple of things. One, Steve Jobs never let his kids use iPads. Mark Zuckerberg also didn't let his, you know, is also not letting his, well, actually not Mark, I'm sorry, Bill Gates also did not let his daughter use very much technology. Most of these, you know, many parents in Silicon Valley do not let their kids use apps or have a lot of screen time because they understand what it does to your brain. Because they built the technology themselves. So from an educational perspective, the best thing you can do, I would say, is probably experiential learning, right? Like, kids learn best by trying to solve problems and by thinking about how to solve those problems. So you can integrate math skills, you can integrate reading skills and writing skills, all of those things into solving real problems. You can teach them coding through solving real problems. You got to have a screen for that, but it's a useful skill, so I would say it's worth it. Yeah, I mean, there are so many ways to inject your educational system with learning that's built around solving real-world problems, and that is definitely the thing that's going to prepare them the most for our robot, the future of our robot overlords.
Yeah, so it sounds to me like what you're saying is that cultural anthropology classes would be really effective. but a related question is, someone asked, why is it that we seem to welcome and even get excited about all of these new AI applications, this new artificial intelligence, when it seems like the ultimate end of it would be the obsolescence of humans?
Well, there are a couple of answers to that question. There are a lot of marketing dollars that go into artificial intelligence right now. There's a lot of journalistic hype around artificial intelligence right now. It's a kind of an exciting thing. You know, we're able to do all of these. We're able to process tons and tons of transactions and numbers and identify new things and find new patterns in the world. That's exciting. That's actually pretty cool. I think the thing. What was the beginning of the question?
Why do you get so excited and even welcome these
right.
applications when it ultimately is going to lead to human outcomes?
Yeah, I mean, so I think of technology like a river. You're not going to stop AI. And that's mostly because it's being developed and being pushed along by a capitalistic system that rewards increasing profits quarter over quarter. And in order to increase your profits quarter over quarter, there's no better way than to become more efficient, right? That's the thing you can count on without having to necessarily think about creating new paradigms or new systems. And so when that's your focus, AI is a huge opportunity for you because you then no longer have to employ as many people. You no longer need as many people to do the calculations that they're doing. So from a company perspective, from a capitalistic perspective, from a shareholder perspective, AI is great, right? You're going to keep making more and more and more money. So that's why, you know, it's not that hard to understand why. And there are a lot of benefits to it. You know, we're finding cures to diseases that we never would have been able to find before. Would have taken us years and years to find. But yeah, that's kind of in a nutshell why the marketing dollars behind it.
So this is a kind of general question. You cite a lot of studies and interesting findings in your presentation, but is there something that all of these scholars are missing, something that you can see from your perspective looking out at all of this research as something that people should be looking at but they're not, or potential for a solution that maybe people aren't quite aware of yet?
I think that there's some really interesting possible applications of artificial or augmented reality that could be used to, I'm just brainstorming, so I'm just coming up with this off the cuff. But when I think about augmented reality, I think one of the most interesting things about it is that you could actually use that to program in your desires, right? Your privacy desires, your privacy preferences, your ongoing, you know, you could use it to say, hey, I want to be able to emotionally connect with more people, or I want you to give me problems that stress my critical thinking and cause me to think critically. That doesn't exist yet, but it would be a really cool application of augmented reality if it were to exist. And I think it would be a really interesting and kind of fun way to gamify the whole process of moving away from the shallows of the internet and back towards more critical thinking in society.
So this is more of a, this is a comment instead of a question, but a father of two daughters just wanted to note that he believes your father would be especially proud of you. But a question that we have here from a student is about what are the implications of all of this for democracy in terms of, is there anything that individuals can really do to affect changes at such a broad level to take control back of our personal data and our privacy?
Yeah, so I think there's actually a lot that we can do. Also, thank you to the father, whoever you are. I'm sure if my father's watching, he's honored. So I talked about a lot of things that we can do already. So you can, there's a lot of kind of critical thinking that you can do on your own, not to get worked up about things that you see online, right? There's so much media out there that is purposefully designed to exacerbate the right side, left side divide in the United States, especially. I get really frustrated, for example, whenever I see news companies publish articles that said, this bill passed a win for Democrats or a win for Republicans. I feel like that is such a disservice to the American public, because what we need to know about a bill that passes is not who it is a win for. We need to know who that bill is going to affect and in what ways. And so if we as journalists could change the way that we write about politics, I think it would have a huge impact on the way that the American public thinks about politics. I would love to see that happen. The other thing is, I mean, as I mentioned, you talk to people. You should be talking to your friends about these things. These are really important issues, and I think that there's a fear of talking about politics, especially now, because we're feeling very divided. But all of the problems that I laid out here today affect people on both sides of the aisle, and we might have different ideas about how to solve those problems, but those are conversations that we should be having and that are worth having, right? And so the more that we're talking to people in our family or in our community, those are the people that actually change each other's minds, right? And those are the people that you actually listen to when they have concerns or when they have, you know, problems that they're dealing with. So you should be talking to the people around you about these things. That's like one of the biggest things. The second thing, which I brought up a little bit earlier, is if you know people who work for tech companies, you should be talking to them about these things, because they should know that you're worried about these things. They should know, if they work for Facebook, that you're worried about how Facebook is affecting the human behavior and that you think they're doing a really bad job. Because that's you know, that kind of mass conversation and mass awareness is what's going to actually change the conversation. And that's what influences employees, right? And as we mentioned, employees are what influence or shareholder resolutions. If you own shares in these companies, you can also put forward your own shareholder resolutions. But yeah, there are a lot of ways that we can kind of try to start changing these things, and they're already happening. So there's actually a lot of things to be hopeful about and to be excited about, because there are a lot of people out there that really want to see these problems solved. So I think it's really cool. I've traveled a bunch to Europe in the last year. I've been lucky enough to get invited to speak over there quite a bit. And I've talked to all of their lawmakers, I've talked to a bunch of European politicians, and they're very worried about this. They're very concerned about it. And they're really trying very hard to do things that they think will fix these problems. So we in the United States are not alone. You are not alone in your concerns. And just talk to each other.
So we've had a couple of questions about automation and the loss of jobs. And this is something that has come up with my students as well in my classes. They're really thinking about, as they graduate, how is the future of their employment going to be different than it was for people graduating 10, 20 years ago? So one person wants to know, it looks like the jobs that will be first to go, like you mentioned, would be truck drivers, Uber drivers, and service industry jobs. So what are the implications there for inequality? Is it going to be these lower paid, low status jobs that are mostly affected? And if so, is that going to create a more unequal society? And the other question, kind of related to that, is if these jobs are replaced by technology, what are all of these unemployed people going to do to earn a living?
That's a great question. So we had a really great conversation about this earlier at CWA. So I'm drawing on the ideas of not brilliant ideas of not just me, but two other folks that were on that panel with me. But yes, we are going to see this change and the shift in artificial intelligence and automation. It is going to disproportionately affect those who are less economically advantaged than those who are more economically advantaged. That is a serious problem, and that's why you've seen Silicon Valley actually very interested in this concept of universal basic income, right? Because they know that they still need people to be able to buy products, otherwise their companies are screwed, right? So there's been a lot of interest in universal basic income. I'm not sure that that's like the best option, not because I don't think it works. Of all the studies that we've seen, people do not waste the money. They actually spend it on things that are useful for them, which is the most common critique. But I do think that it would be almost better to put that money into putting people back to work, right? So we have tons of roads across the United States that need to be fixed. We have no train infrastructure. We have no electric train infrastructure. How are we going to transport people en masse in a green way from one side of the country to the other? We have no education programs for people who are needing to learn these new skills, right? Maybe if you're a truck driver, you suddenly learn to repair robots, right? That's another thing you could learn to do. And so there's going to need to be a massive reinvestment in education, basically, a massive retraining effort. And I think that should be free, right? That's something that would actually benefit a huge number of people. That's actually not my idea. That's Moses Ma's idea from our panel the other day, but it's a great idea, and it would make a huge difference. It would make a huge difference in our ability to continue innovating and continue, feeling safe and secure in our country. So that would be one really great idea.
So this question's about the individual consent model. So when you go to different websites, this thing pops up. Do you agree to use cookies? Do you agree to accept cookies? And read these terms and conditions. They're really long. And do you agree as a condition to downloading this app or using this website? What about, is it a problem when you start looking at genetic data, like you were mentioning with 23andMe, that one person could give their consent to the genetic data being processed, but then all of their biological relatives and this whole network of other people get implicated. So do you have any ideas about looking beyond the individual consent model for personal data and privacy?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So we're at the point right now where there's enough of a publicly available genetic database, which is kind of alluded to in this question, that I think it's about 60% of people that can be identified just by if you have the genetic data of their relatives or people around them. And so that's a serious concern. I don't know off the top of my head what the answer to that is. I think there is an interesting question. There's a lot of work to be done in the field of genetic data, right? There's a lot of work to be done in the field of genetic data. data. If you're interested in that, the group that I mentioned, I'm trying to remember their name, the Future of Privacy Forum, I think is what they're called. They are doing really interesting work, and that would be a really good question to field their way, because they're directly working with those companies to try to protect people and protect your genetic data.
So I think we have time for one last question, and this is a kind of fun one. It came in through the app. Someone wants to know, are you running for president in 2020?
I think the field is crowded enough, but I would be open to advising someone on how to move forward on technology.